Earlier, we probably haven't, but we're at a certain age, you know. The mind's not as fun as it once was.
And these are three public hearings only.
Ready, Paul?
You bet. Yeah, nice work on that.
Hey, where's my script?
Lord.
Green paper. Put it on green.
Yeah, I got it.
Just open up your schedule.
Can I find it?
See.
You notice?
Hey, good morning. Good morning, everyone.
Yeah.
We'll open the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection Thursday, March 31st, 2011. Good morning. I should have done that first. Committee members and interested spectators, we're going to start with House Bill 3195 to accommodate some members' schedules. Jan, if you'd please give us a summary, and it's Representative Esquivel.
House Bill 3195, it provides that if a government agency lawfully conducts a transaction by electronic means, then it is presumed that the person agrees to conduct the transaction by electronic means. And it provides that if a law requires an original signature on a record, then an electronic signature satisfies the law in certain circumstances. And it provides that an electronic signature is an original signature if certain provisions are satisfied. When recording with the county clerk the instruments that convey an interest in real property, it applies to documents recorded or presented for recording before, on, or after the effective date, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative. Please, as a reminder, identify yourself for the record and give us your concise testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chairs, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. This bill that we have in front of us is long overdue. As we know, as we go into the technological age where we have the ability to transfer hundreds of thousands of dollars electronically, when we have the ability to have documents signed electronically for purchases of large purchases of either products, homes, and or businesses, then it's time that we have a recordation of the document between the companies, the title companies, as well as people, and our county clerks. And this is what this is about. It's about an electronic recordation of a document into a deed that goes into the county. It's a permissive bill. I think we've done some good work with the one amendments, which I hope we have. So, therefore, I'm just here, and my good friend Alan Brickley is here, and it's hard for me to sit here because he is an attorney, and I do joke with him about him being one, but I will turn it over to him.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Brickley, go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman Wisnant and members of the committee, just a little bit of a background.
Your name just one more time.
I'm sorry. My name again is Alan, A-L-A-N, Brickley, B-R-I-C-K-L-E-Y. I'm counsel with First American Title Insurance Company in Portland, Oregon. I'm actually here on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association as well. Just by way of background, the legislature adopted the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act approximately 10 years ago, and many people feel that that is sufficient legal basis in which to do electronic recording. However, there is some differences of opinion, and as a result of that, notwithstanding the fact that Jackson County adopted protocols and has been electronic recordings for approximately 1 year, there was a lawsuit brought by one of the title insurance companies against them because they didn't feel that there was sufficient legal basis in the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. The local circuit court has rendered a decision in favor of the act being sufficient. However, it is on appeal, so rather than waiting for that appeal, and, you know, the expense and the uncertainty of the outcome, this legislation is simply designed to take care of the issue, the legal issue that was raised in that case. Essentially what it is, the statute requires that the county clerk view the original signature on the document, and of course the original signature is not on the document because it's electronically transmitted. All this bill does is to resolve that specific legal issue. Because there has been some recording that's taken place, that's the reason for the provision in the bill that would, in effect, validate that recording. The other piece of it is permissive. It is not required. It is something that the counties can do if they choose to. I anticipate that a significant number of the counties will go this way because it provides a significant efficiency for the counties to do this without any additional cost.
Thank you very much. Do you want to address what did the Dash 1 bring into the bill, too?
Essentially, what the Dash 1 amendments, let me back up. The original LC draft, unfortunately, did not address the basic problem of the original signature. And essentially, what the Dash 1 amendments do is just to reconfigure that to more specifically address the original signature problem.
Good. Thank you. Committee members, questions?
Mr. Chair. I'd like to add, try to illustrate the problem. When you have three or four different title companies, in some places 9 or 10 title companies, and you have one county, it's very difficult to get these people to not have to have certain time slots in order to record documents. What this allows is, at a touch of a button, they can record the document immediately, and that way the transaction's been closed at that point, because your time frames vary on when you get monies in to purchase a piece of property and or a home. And this will allow the latitude of, one, you don't have to run a bunch of people up and down the highways between the county and the title company, but more importantly, there'd be no set time at that point where you would record a document at any time.
Thank you very much, Representative. Thank both of you for your expertise.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So who is responsible for keeping the original signature, or is anyone responsible for it?
Well, the original document is... in effect, immediately returned to the consumer. Currently, the original document is placed with the county clerk. They photocopy it, and then they index it.
Mm-hmm.
And several days later, it either will be mailed back to them or picked up by the title company. In some manner, it gets back to the original consumer. In this particular situation, the document is transmitted electronically. The consumer will, in effect, be handed the document back, because the information, the recording information, will be transmitted back to the sender so that they know it's been processed by the county clerk, and the original signature is then given to the consumer.
Okay, so the notarizing, for example, will still take place as it normally would. There's no lowering of the standard of quality and confirmation of the recording documents?
No, none whatsoever. The acknowledgement process is still in place. There will be there's no change other than the method of transmission from one place to another.
Got it.
Your notarization would be done right then and there with the closer.
Right. Good common sense.
Good. Chair Buckley.
Oh, don't try holding. thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Brickley. It's good to see you again. I just have one question. I don't see any documentation or testimony signed up by the county clerks, and was just curious whether or not they're on board with this, and that'd be an important piece for me to know. You know, if we could get them to weigh in before we move this forward, that'd be good.
Yes. I have been in contact with the County Clerks Association from the very beginning of this process, and they have absolutely no objection to it whatsoever. I can provide further information to you if you wish.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if we could just request from that association, they give us some sort of indication of that, so we have that in our files.
Good point. Chair Holby. Any other questions, committee members?
Co-Chair Richardson.
Okay, give me a break, guys. It's early morning. Okay, thank you again for your expert testimony and bring this bill forward. And with that, we have no one else signed up for the bill.
Richardson.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3195. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2020. Jan, please.
Mr. Chair, and members, House Bill 2020, it requires state agencies to report to Ways and Means for each division or unit of the agency the ratio of employees to supervisors, the ratio of employees to managers, and the number of non-supervisory managers, and a description of their duties. It will require Ways and Means to develop a plan to attain a ratio of employees to supervisors and supervisory managers of 11 to 1 for each unit or division of an agency with more than 100 employees. Allows Ways and Means to develop a plan with a different ratio for an agency if it determines it's not possible for the agency to reach the 11 to 1 ratio. It applies to budgets for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2011. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you very much. Is this Representative Holby or Buckley? Peter, good morning, Representative Buckley. Thank you for bringing this bill. Would you please introduce yourself and give us your testimony?
Good morning, Chair Wisman, Chair Holby, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing Ashland in South Jackson County in the legislature. And, Mr. Chair, your comment reminded me in 2005, you might not remember this, but then-Speaker Minnis found it important to gavel me down on the floor one day after a remark I was in the midst of making, but she aimed her ire at Representative Holby while she was gaveling me down, which I thought was perfectly appropriate.
Thank you for that historical review, Representative Buckley. But, you know, I'm not sure that was a good example to bring up in this committee.
Oh, yes.
But I'll hear your bill anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2020 comes to you, and it actually came to me to begin with through the Service Employees International Union suggestions, and also from the work done by John Ramsey, who is a constituent in Jackson County, and the work done in the DHS transformation project over the last several years. As part of that transformation work, the McKinsey report that came out several years ago indicated that there was, just in DHS alone, there's a possibility of removing 1,100 positions in the Department of Human Services by simply restructuring how work was delivered. The department has made, I think, strong steps in that direction. They've been able to do transformation at a good level. What this bill would do would require a plan, would require our partnership in that process, not only for DHS but across state government. It sets forth a method of review of the staffing ratio in each agency and allows us to work with the agency to develop a plan to make that ratio, to increase that ratio to 11 to 1 for agencies that are more than 100 employees. The reason I'm supporting this, and I appreciate the support from so many of my colleagues on this, is that it does provide, it gives us a tool, a methodical tool to use in the work. We've heard, I've met with employees from the state hospital, for instance, who've expressed great frustration with the layers of management they have in order to accomplish the tasks they feel they need to get done. It's an area I think is shared, widespread concern over do we have the right structure for the work. This gives us a way to go into those structures, to work with the agencies, and if we can accomplish even a step each year, each biennium, that will result in significant savings, which are crucially needed in programs such as the programs for seniors and people with disabilities, programs across the board that we all support. So I appreciate your time and consideration of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'm glad to have the support of folks here to testify after me as well.
Thank you, Representative. Committee members, we have we're going to have about six other people from SEIU and from DAS testifying, but if anyone has questions for Representative Buckley, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question that somebody else testifying wants to cover also, and first I want to applaud you for, you know, coming forward with an idea that to save, trying to save the government some money. It's really valuable to hear. I think often we think of kind of service delivery reforms as things being proposed at frontline workers, and having proposals coming from frontline workers who know what's going on is really helpful. A question I do have, though, is what's the right ratio? And maybe that's the ultimate question. And maybe it varies, and maybe the flexibility within the bill is sufficient. How do we know about 11 to 1? I did a you know, sort of the management tools, internet survey search about, like, what's the best number of direct reports. And, you know, 7, 8 seems like a relatively manageable number. Once you get to 12 to 14, it seems sort of a less manageable number. Talk about the number and in some of these contexts, having that layer of management is not necessarily a direct report, right? It's, you know, you don't necessarily report to that person. But talk to us a little bit about that if you can, or maybe you want to defer to others.
Certainly. Co-chairs, vice chair Smith, thank you for this question. 11 to 1 is a goal. We thought we had to set some goal to work with. It's the goal. The state of Texas has that as their goal, and it seems to be a way for them to work towards it. I think the positive thing, one of the positive things about the bill, it allows the Ways and Means subcommittees to work with agencies to use that as a goal, but to take into account what actually the functions of those agencies are. Can it work at 11-1? It might not be able to. In Department of Corrections, for instance, it might be unsafe to work at that level. But that needs to be something that's part of the discussion so we can clarify if the Department of Corrections needs to be at 7-1 or needs to be at 5-1 for safety reasons. Then that should be clear to the subcommittee that that's the reason for that ratio. So basically what the bill does, it sets an aspirational goal and then works towards that with each agency given the circumstances of the work of that agency.
Thanks. Yeah, I've had 10 direct reports before, and it felt about 4 too many, but each of them were doing really different tasks.
Correct.
Each of them were running different programs. So if they were doing relatively similar tasks, it might be easier. So anyway, thanks a lot. It's interesting to me.
Other questions, committee members? Representative Hovey, do you have any?
No, I don't think we're waiting for a fiscal at this point.
Representative Holby, thank you for that comment. Your co-chair constantly told me about the speed in which fiscals are produced by LFO, given the fact that we keep LFO slightly busy with other matters. My apologies for the delay of any fiscals your committee might be awaiting.
Good. Thank you. Representative Buckley, I do thank you, and I saw this bill, and I've been working with AFSCME on some other issues along the same thing. I think I was proposing 1 to 14, in this committee, as we begin the session, I was asking certain agencies that came before us to report back to us as far as vacant FTEs, deputies and assistants, layers of management, and span of control. So I look forward to seeing this bill move forward and hope that we can look at all those aspects because other private companies are doing the same thing. So I think it's time the state government look at those two and try to control those in a responsible manner. So thank you for bringing it forth.
Thank you for your time and consideration.
Mr. Chair, just real quick, are we going to have other testimony on the bill?
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Go balance that budget. With our blessing.
He already did that.
Okay, we'll have Miss Sunger and Mr. Boger, Andrew Boger. Good morning. Please identify yourself and present your concise testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Holvey and Wisnant. Thank you for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm staff with SEIU Local 503. And as Representative Buckley just referred to, this bill came out of a meeting with some DHS workers that he had, where he said, you know, I really think we should just address this through legislation so we can really start to move forward on this issue. And Andy's going to testify a little bit about the methodology we used and how we found the potential cost savings. He was a researcher who worked on this piece of the report. So I'm going to let him talk about that. But I think I want to tell a little bit how this came to be. Many of you may know that we did a frontline worker survey of about 16,000. We sent it out to about 16,000 people, and we had over 10% of the people actually respond to the survey and fill out a pretty detailed survey about efficiencies and savings in government. And this was the second highest response that we got from workers, was that there was a problem with staff management ratio, and it was across the board in every agency. And I think while we began the research because of their concerns, we were surprised to also find that there's significant cost savings. And at a time when we're proposing significant cuts to schools and to seniors and to public safety, we really thought it was the appropriate time to really bring this forward and start this conversation. And I do want to address Representative Smith's question in terms of drafting the bill and the 11-1 ratio. We use that ratio because it's the best example we found of another state. And when you do look and you do a search, there's lots of examples out there of the right ratio, 1 to 10, 1 to 12, 1 to 14. And that's why we really tried to make sure that there was a process that it wasn't a ratio that had to be met for every agency, that there could be a discussion based on the services that agency provides. Because I think that's a really important piece of this, is that the idea, the way that our frontline workers have talked about it, is that it really causes inefficiency, and it causes layers of management. And so we want to make sure that the goal of this is to provide better services, and so let's talk about what services and what's the right ratio for each different agency. And so that's why we have the two different versions. 11-to-1 is a goal, or another one. You know, the other piece that we try to strive for is to ensure that we didn't expect everyone to go to 11-to-1 this biennium, and we cut their budgets to base that on it, that we didn't think that that was realistic in terms of making sure that we don't interrupt the services that Oregonians rely on. And so those were kind of the process we went through to find and develop the bill. And, you know, I think the most important part of this bill is that ratios are something that should be evaluated on a regular basis and talked about. If they're not evaluated over time, you know, I think they get people get hired without a review about how they help deliver services to Oregonians. And it's clear, I think, that from our survey, that people really do believe this causes inefficiency and an inability to do their job in the way that they want to. The other piece I want to note about the bill is that it also mandates that there's a review of managerial employees. And you'll notice in the handout that we probably just gave you that we differentiate between supervisory employees and managerial employees. And I'm going to let Andy talk a little bit about that. But we do in the bill say we should review these positions. And I want to make it clear that we understand that there's a reason that managers exist sometimes that don't oversee employees, right? Confidential employees, maybe they're overseeing a big project, but there's not any direct reports. That makes sense. But what we're really asking is that there's a review of this process, and there's a review of who these people are and what kind of services they provide to ensure that they're that they actually help deliver the critical services that people rely on, especially at a time when, you know, there's proposals to close some schools and have seniors lose the care that they rely on. So, you know, we really believe that this is an opportunity, as legislators and the governor have said, to reshape government, and we think evaluating span of control and increasing the worker-to-manager ratio will make government more efficient at the same time as protect critical services. So I appreciate your time today, and I'm going to let Andy talk about the different methodology, but feel free to ask me any questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony. Mr. Boger, if you'll identify yourself and present.
Yes. Good morning, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Andy Boger. I'm a researcher with Service Employees International Union, Local 503. So I wanted to talk a little bit about in sort of an as interesting as or at least as painless way as possible about the methodology I use for coming up with some of these ratio numbers and cost savings estimates. Basically, we got payroll data from the Department of Administrative Services for just one day, January 21st, 2011, And it's executive branch data only, excludes the legislative branch, excludes lottery, excludes the judicial department, and also excludes temporary workers. And the data indicates for each position the representation status or representation code of that position. I'll talk a little bit more about those in a minute. The position classification and monthly base pay if the position is filled, and also the percentage funding split. In other words, how much of the funding for the position comes from the general fund, from the lottery fund, and so forth. So to come up with the managerial and supervisory ratios, we essentially assigned every position to a category based upon the so-called REPR codes. They call them a representation codes. And these are codes that, in the case of, for example, most of the members of our union belong to SEIU non-strikeable. Or SEIU strikeable or non-strikeable, okay? The managerial and supervisory positions, the vast majority of them are in a set of four codes: executive service, supervisory, executive service, non-supervisory, which would be the managerial non-supervisory one, and then there's management service, supervisory, management service, non-supervisory. And then there's a few smaller codes as well for the managerial and supervisory ones. So in the supervisory category, there were, as of January 21st of this year, 4,133 filled positions out of 4,625 total. And the managerial non-supervisory category is a bit more amorphous, because these are folks that range all the way from people who lobby you, lobby the legislature, to policy other kinds of policy analysts and very highly paid professionals, to support staff who are in that category because they're considered confidential employees under the terms of the Oregon Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act. So I would say about a quarter of these people roughly make $40,000 a year or less, but the rest much more. So that's sort of a, and they're relatively, this is a relatively smaller category versus the supervisory, as of January, 1,211 filled positions. And then the other box that we used was the worker box, which was pretty much everybody else. 28,959 filled positions in January. So I constructed two ratios, and the ratios capture different things. One is the supervisory ratio, which is a ratio of workers and the managerial non-supervisory staff to supervisors. Okay? And the other is the ratio of, the managerial ratio is the ratio of workers to supervisors and managerial non-supervisory staff taken together. Okay? So they illustrate different things. One is more about authority and control. The supervisory ratio is actually more formally the span of control ratio. But the other, but it's important to take into account also the presence of this group of managerial non-supervisory staff. So in order to come up with the cost savings estimates of moving, of improving these ratios, we looked at base salaries. We converted them to total compensation using a standard sort of formula provided by DAS for accounting for the cost of health care and Social Security and PERS and so forth. And we looked at this using two different methods. One method that I first used was to look only at positions that were filled. The downside of this method is that positions can become vacant or unfilled for a lot of different reasons, and because positions are vacant on January 21st doesn't mean that they're vacant for the majority of the biennium, and you get into some sort of problems there with the extent to which the data is representative of the whole picture. So if we improved each agency's managerial ratio using the positions at current staffing levels or as January staffing levels, if we improved each agency's managerial ratio by one each year of the biennium, we'd save about $230.2 million all funds and total compensation costs, or about 64.5 of that would be in general fund. The other method that we used, and this is a method that we presented the numbers in our report. These are the numbers we presented in our report. Was assuming that all positions would be filled, and using that as a basis for our estimate. And the thinking here was that this should be closer to the budgeted numbers. And since what we're trying to do here is think about the budget and influence and look for cost savings in the budget, we thought it makes sense to look at numbers that were closer to the budgetary numbers. So the downside is that for the vacant positions, we're forced to use the average compensation for workers in that category for that agency. So in other words, for the vacant supervisory positions, we assume that those people would be paid the same as supervisors in that agency who are currently employed on average. So improving each agency's managerial ratio by one each year of the biennium, we would save about $253.5 million all funds, of which about $71 million would be general fund. So the numbers are slightly higher if you base it on all positions. So I hope this wasn't too much detail for you, but I just kind of wanted to kind of get the numbers out there and share with you some of our assumptions.
Thank you, sir. Committee members? Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First for Ms. Unger. You said that this was the number two in your employee survey, the number two highest suggestion. What was number one?
Representative Conger, co-chairs, it was processes. And so it's interesting because I was looking through that last night when I was preparing this testimony, and some of the processes actually have to do with the managerial ratio as well, where they say it takes too many steps to get a piece of paper approved. And that was really the number one comment, is just how do we take product to finish, and how do we streamline that process.
Well, I hope that you will work with the agencies to try to improve that as well, and achieve savings there for us as well.
Representative Conger, co-chairs, we definitely intend to take everything that came out of the survey, and one of the things that we're doing just internally, so you know, is we're taking kind of, this was the first step, is to go through and take some of the highest comments, but then in the process these time, there's lots of different smaller things that we kind of added into the overall process comment. And so how do we dig through that and find out what are the options? And one of the recommendations that we have is just generally is let's set up some labor management committees where we can really start to address these and really evaluate what are things that are done for a reason and what are things that are done that just cause backlog in the way that work is done.
Well, as you increase the ratio, you should be bringing the layers of management down to make that process. You have another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question and then a couple of quick points. I won't monopolize a lot of time, but I want to try to get these in just so we're thinking about them. What are the odds, do you think, that ultimately the agencies will simply reclassify employees and put them into a different code to manipulate the ratios that you've come up with?
Representative Conger, co-chairs, I think that we really do believe that agencies are well-intended in how they deliver services, and I think our goal here is that an evaluation is done and we start to follow up on that on a regular process, during the budget process. And I think that if we really do get a point where they're coming back and answering questions about their ratios every biennium, and that we're really looking at both the supervisory ratio and the managerial employees, that those conversations in the agencies will really move them in the process of how do we bring down the span of control and make sure that it's more efficient. And so I really hope, and I do believe that, you know, from the response that we've gotten from certain agencies, that they want to work on this problem, that they want to work with us on this, and that we really can move forward together after this evaluation and figure out how to implement it, especially, I think, if they're also being held accountable here in the legislature to answering questions about their ratios.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one more follow-up. I appreciate that, and I didn't mean to imply that anything sinister, yeah. Just that in many cases, to respond to the pressure to change the span of control, it might be easier just to reclassify some employees and, you know, kind of get us off their back. Not evil intent,
yeah.
Just natural human nature. A couple of quick points. I think that it would be important to take into consideration the vacant FTEs in this process, and I believe that you said that you had done that. You were only taking positions that were actually filled at the time where you established the ratios. I'm not sure you need to put that into legislation, but obviously that's an issue that has come up in this committee and would distort this if somehow that isn't evaluated on an ongoing basis. The second point that I wanted to make is I've checked with sort of done my own unscientific polling of some folks who I know who are very knowledgeable in the private sector, and it turns out that, and many on this committee probably already know this, but I'll share it anyway, it turns out that really efficient companies often fall in a range of 8 to 12 span of control. So, as has already been pointed out, there's no science to whether or not 11 is the right number. I suppose you have to establish a goal. But where that plays into my final comment is in the language of the bill, we use the word possible. So if it's possible to have a different span of control or a different ratio It would always be possible to have a different ratio, but it might not be efficient. And what I wanted to suggest is that perhaps better language could be determined or could be prepared in an amendment to say if the Ways and Means Committee and the agencies agree that it would be more efficient mm-hmm. or more effective to have a different ratio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other committee members, questions? Representative Hope, Chair Hovey, you had some.
Thank you. Actually, Representative Conger sort of touched on my question that I was curious about the, you know, the nuances between budgeted and actual filled employed positions, and I think both of those are somewhat relevant. I don't know that I've figured out which one I think is mm-hmm. right yet. I don't know if I know enough to make that decision yet, because I think having the actual filled and employed positions is perhaps where the money's at, as opposed to the vacant positions. So that's something I'm thinking about. And I heard you walk through the nuances of managerial employees, and after reading the statute about what the definition of a managerial employee is, I think that's a I think that's going to be kind of tough to get a really, you know, tight definition of what that is, so that we can make sure that we know what we're talking about when we talk about managerial employees that are in a supervisory capacity, I suppose. So I don't know if that needs more work. Maybe Das has some thoughts on that as well. And my final question, and you may not be the right one to answer this, I'm kind of curious what... if you looked at what are the current ratios that we have in our agencies, I'm not sure I heard that. If you said it, I apologize.
Yeah, Representative Hovey and Co-Chair Wisnett. So there's a couple of different things on that. One, the moving to 11 to 1 is meant to be supervisory employees and not really managerial employees. And so we don't really, I think that the drafters really came up with the language managerial employees acting in a supervisory capacity. And we really meant that 11 to 1 to be the supervisory ratio. And so we have, have said that we think that that means the same thing, and that the drafters just wanted to put that in just in case there's people who are working in a supervisory capacity who are classified as managers. So our intent was not to have the managerial ratio be the 11 to 1, but the supervisory ratio be 11 to 1. And what we did in the bill to address that is we really did say, let's look at this, and then let's evaluate what these folks do, these managers do, because I think as Andy pointed out, a lot of them actually do... you know, some of them are classified employees, but a lot of them are not. And so what are those roles, especially at a time when looking at cutting positions and cutting services. But I do think you were handed this, and it goes back to what I think Representative Conger was going to. It has filled only and filled and unfilled for each agency in terms of ratios. In addition to the ratios, we just actually provided the actual number of positions in each classification. And so this is, I think you have, and I think statewide for filled, we have a ratio of 1 to 7.3 for supervisory currently.
Okay, thank you. Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you mentioned this during your presentation, I apologize if I had to step out for a second. So I was looking at the Google here, and Texas apparently has changed recently from full-time employee, no, actual headcount of employees rather than FTE, and the bill just sort of says public employees. Do you know whether we're talking headcount or FTE in the desires of the bill?
In our current bill, I believe the idea was to talk about the headcount rather than FTE. The data that we worked from in preparing this analysis includes both full and part-time employees. Because of the way the payroll data is set up, it's difficult. It doesn't, in the payroll system, it doesn't break down the percentage of FTE for each position. So we just counted each as one.
I can't. And that's what Texas eventually did. They changed. I don't know exactly what they're, if that was just, it was vague, and you know, people were interpreting it one way, but like in one example, there was a, where is it? Anyway, one full-time employee, three half-time employees. You could either count that 1 to 4 or 1 to 2.5, and now it would be 1 to 4 in the Lone Star State.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony and clarifying some of your results.
Thank you.
Joe Bosler asked me. Come on up, Joe. Thank you. Identify yourself and give us your concise testimony, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon AFSCME, Company 5, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent about 24,000 members across the state, and about a third, slightly more than a third, are state employees. I don't want to sort of repeat what's already been said, but we're very supportive of the bill. We think that the work that was done was really well done. The one thing I can add, we're looking at this. We also represent a lot of local governments. Multnomah County, for instance, we are looking at a way to try to move folks from managerial positions down to lead worker status so that the services that they are supervising, they're also help providing. And there's a couple of different methods to achieving some of these goals. And we think that some of our best employers are really working hard to achieve these.
Cool.
But other than that, I really have nothing to add.
Thank you. I hope that we can pass this legislation and set the example for our cities and states. Thanks, sir. And I had, is it Rob Sisk and Mary Stewart had signed up? Good morning. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Good morning. Co-chair Representative Holvey, Risnett, members of the committee. My name is Mary Stewart, and I currently work for SEIU Local 503. I'm also employed as a tax auditor for the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to testify to you about the management to staff ratios. It's probably a reverence to start off with a joke, but the situation, from my perspective, reminds me of a very old one. And that's how many managers does it take to change a light bulb? So there's a section manager who notifies a facility manager who notifies an office manager. Well, nowadays there's a process manager to review the process, a developmental process manager who hires a consultant to review the process. There's a manager to hold meetings and hold communication seminars about it. There's a manager to blog about it. Finally, a facility manager sends a notice to the maintenance manager who tells the custodial supervisor, who asks a custodian, please change the light bulb. Process takes 10 managers in approximately a year. Meanwhile, frontline employee bought a new light bulb and changed it the day after. Now, we'd probably all be laughing, but this is a really, really serious issue, and this is something that's going on in our agencies. And I know it's exaggerated, but we have seen both a vertical and a horizontal expansion of managers while at the same time we're working with either the same level or fewer frontline workers. At one time, an office manager may have supervised an entire office staff, including support workers, technical staff, professional staff, and others. The office manager reported to a division manager who reported to an agency head. Currently, there are managers for each of those classifications, and those managers report to other managers who report to division managers, who report to administrators, who finally report to directors. I previously worked in private industry where senior management played a much more immediate role in day-to-day operations. They were in touch with frontline issues, and the decision process for changes and improvements and in problem solving took relatively a short time, sometimes as little as yes or no for an answer. Today I work in a state agency. I realize that the levels of responsibility and security are much more acute. However, if I need a subpoena to obtain tax records, I must state my reasons to my office manager, who will in turn take it to a division manager, who will then take it to an administrator. The decision may not be approved in a timely process. It may take weeks. I have witnessed where other auditors have waited many weeks. Sometimes no decision gets made. The multiple layers, both horizontally and vertically, are an impediment to efficiency and process improvements, as well as a costly expenditure in both salaries and benefits. The costs and inefficiencies do not serve the day-to-day operations of the agency, and they fail to meet our constituents' expectations of excellent or at least good customer service. In truth, the current management's to staff ratios perpetuate the reality of bloated and inefficient government, something I know we all take seriously and something I think we're working to change. I urge the committee to closely examine how our state agencies are structured, the multiple and duplicate layers of management that each agency maintains. What is the cost of excess and duplicate management? And do the costs justify a meaningful purpose? I believe that we are both in fundamental agreement that we can and must do much better. In closing, the real answer to the light bulb story is one. It's the accounting manager who approved the reimbursement for the cost of the light bulb. Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mrs. Stewart. Mr. Sisk?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Robert Sisk, president of DAFS, SEIU Local 125, which represents over 400 frontline workers that provide critical services to the state agencies so they can do the important work that they are charged with in serving the citizens of this state. Currently, DAS has an employee-to-manager ratio of a little over 2-1. While we realize that not all managers in DAS are supervisory, and we understand that some programs, due to the nature of the work, non-supervisory managers may be necessary, we nonetheless believe there is an inordinate number of both designations. We also believe if we are to develop a lean, efficient, cost-saving state government that still provides critical services, these numbers need to be reviewed and actually pared down significantly. A cumbersome bureaucracy is a cumbersome budget. And also, significant higher pay ranges for managers mean that this takes away for the funds that can pay for frontline positions that really do the work and provide the basic services. And I'm glad, by the way, that Melissa Unger was asked about what the top survey result was, and that's in processes because I want to actually tie these two together. Anyhow, the layers of management hinder the ability of state government to deliver services swiftly and efficiently by creating too much red tape and with slow decision-making processes and approvals, as well as burdensome and confusing communication loops. I just want to point out one story which maybe makes this tie. I was asked by an agency to create a commemorative rose bed, and because of the layers of management, the agency is charged almost three times what my base rate is for these services, okay? And they were giving a bid by our management for the rose bed, and it was so exorbitant that they actually got an outside contractor to do the work. The tie-in to this is not only the cost of that project due to the layers of management and the overhead, but without my involvement, in which case I would have said, hey, I can absorb this work into my daily schedule. Basically, the only thing that would cost them extra is the materials, okay? So that's one of the tie-ins. Which brings me to the solution is to create a more self-directed workforce that engages in the tactical and strategic planning of the agency and is trained to make on-the-spot decisions for efficiency and whose ideas for streamlining work can be listened to and incorporated. This is ORS 240-850, which was passed by the legislature in 93 and was intended to inspire this kind of high-performance structure. Unfortunately, it is very obscure and as a result has largely not been promoted or responded to by agencies. Being aware of this and having been extensively involved in this philosophy and its application, I drafted a proposed article for the current DAS state worker contract. And this language would really have the agencies develop a high-performance strategy, and which would involve more employee self-direction and calls for an annual progress report from the agency to make sure this philosophy is being developed. I think the benefits of a more self-directed and empowered workforce essentially are that the workers become stakeholders in the process. They become more energized to their ownership, more dedicated and committed. Plus, we get to take advantage of their brains in developing successful outlines, outcomes of projects, because they know the system, they know the work. Instead of a state government that is teetering from being top-heavy, for the good of our citizens, we need to redirect our resources to ensure a strong foundation of frontline workers providing basic services in an efficient and cost-saving manner. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Committee members? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your excellent testimony. I want to make sure that I understand the numbers that are on this page, and maybe you can answer them or somebody else. So when I look at, for example, Department of Revenue on here, and I want to make sure I understand what the bill is going after on which column here. Are we after the supervisory ratio or the managerial ratio in this bill? Can somebody explain that? Because when you look at Department of Revenue, just the filled positions, we're at a 9.8 currently on the supervisory ratio, and we're on a 7.4. And I'm trying to do the math on this spreadsheet, and I'm not quite coming up with the right numbers. And then at DAS, we had a reference to the managerial column of 2.0, but on the supervisory ratio, we're at 6.3. So I want to understand the math first and what we're really after here.
Why don't you identify yourself? Give me a listen.
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, for the record, Melissa Unger, SEAU Local 503.
Thanks, Melissa.
So in the bill, there's really two different pieces. I think we talk a lot about the managerial ratio because we have a big concern with the number of managers who do not supervise and what their roles are. But the actually 1-11 ratio would deal with the supervisory ratio particularly. So the way that the two numbers are calculated is the supervisory ratio is supervisors, the column of supervisors, divided by everyone else. And then the managerial ratio is determined by supervisors plus managers divided by everyone else. So that's how the two numbers are come up with. And in the bill, it says let's determine both ratios. Let's review the managerial positions that don't supervise and see what they do. But then it really moves the supervisory ratio to 11-1. I think that there's some reasons, and we understand those reasons, that there may be some need for managerial employees. But we do think there needs to be a review. And when we determined our cost savings, we definitely did say we should move the managerial ratio to really evaluate who those people are who are currently not supervising. But we based it off the Texas law, and the Texas law is based off supervisory. So that's what we did in the bill.
Just thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Melissa. And just to clarify then, so it would be the second to last column is what the 11-1 ratio would be looking at. So when we're referencing DAS, for example, it's not 2.0 to 11.0. Today it's 6.3 to 11.0 is what we would be comparing to, correct?
That is correct.
And at Department of Revenue, we would be looking at 9.8 to 11.0.
That is correct. And one clarification, that is right. The one thing I would note is the bill does say let's review the manager's employees before the 11-1 ratio, so that there is a conversation about those other employees as well.
Okay. And just, if I may, Mr. Chair, because I'm going to have to leave committee a little bit early today, I just want to make a comment. I think this is great that we're doing this, and just being having a lot of experience in private industry and in a specific industry, and I know that ratios can differ. And I'm just thinking of the restaurant business. If you have a restaurant business that has 100 frontline employees in it and two or three managers in it versus a restaurant that has 4 employees in it and you still have to have somebody who's, quote, the supervisor in charge, you're going to have a lot of different ratios in a lot of different places. And so I want to caution us to make sure we're considering in here that one size does not fit all. And if this is a goal towards our state being more efficient and effective, that's the right thing to do. And I think the bill is worded in a way that forces people to come forward with their plans and expose and question areas of. But again, thank you for bringing this bill forward and your testimony today.
Representative Smith, thank you.
Yeah,
Representative
thanks.
Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Spinning off that, the looking down that second to last column, and look, and I can go back. We use that restaurant example, or sort of, you know, the example I used versus a buddy of mine who ran Fisherman in Alaska, and they had, you know, and he had like 40, you know, he had like 40 direct reports, and they were relatively autonomous, and they did somewhat similar, you know, sort of similar tasks. And I look at here like the advocacy commissions, you know, which is like one, and I know who they supervise are like community relationships, right? And might be similar with, you know, the therapist board, right? We don't have a bunch of state therapists. What they're supposed to do is work with the outside world. And so we might think about, as we go through this, and I don't, maybe there's something in the wording of the bill we need to address, but as we think about implementation, we might create a methodology or set of categories that helps us understand, so we don't go to the advocacy commission and say, hey, what the hell, you're still you're one to, you know, what the heck, you know, what's the ratio, we got to fire, you know, but instead say, oh, well, this is that kind of thing versus this is that kind of thing, and it allows us to evaluate a little more granularly, a little more wisely.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Smith. We have one more witness to testify. So, Chair Holby, you had one question first?
No.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this. Mr. Michael Jordan from DAS, please.
Chair Jordan.
I wish he'd have been on the court last week to help the Tar Heels, but...
never gets old. I love it.
Chair Jordan.
That's over. 32. What's going on?
Good morning, sir. Please morning. Identify yourself. Welcome and provide
good morning. My name is Michael J. Jordan. Same middle name, too, by the way.
Oh, yes.
And I am currently the acting chief operating officer and director at DAS. I haven't been confirmed yet, so I just want that to be clear. I'm on thin ice here already. I've passed some written testimony out. My comments will be very brief on this issue. I am now just over 3 days on the job, so I don't have a great depth of experience yet at what's going on inside state government and the agencies, and many of the things you'll see in my written remarks have been brought up already. So, first of all, in going through this discussion, I am firmly convinced that we have a span of control problem and a levels problem in state government. So, in concept, I'm totally in support of a review of these things. And most of the complications that come in doing this kind of work, at least in my experience over time, have been brought up already. You've got certain functions that may be isolated logistically, either through geography or some other logistical impediment that causes one supervisor, as Representative Smith brought up, to supervise a small number of people because of logistics. You certainly have different types of work being done across state government, some of which may require very close supervision, some of which may not. I also believe that we're going to have to do a lot more study on the issue of the actual cost savings. Many, many, many managers, not just in state government, but in all public work, in my experience, are working managers. Only part of their job description is actually supervision. They almost all carry some kind of workload. If, in fact, those ratios change, that work doesn't go away. And so the cost savings may be a little more difficult to define than it seems on the surface. So those are just a few things that I think and are in the written testimony that we need to consider as we go through this. However, let me reiterate, this work has to be done. We've got some significant issues across state government. This notion of non-supervisory managers in all of our agencies needs to be reviewed. There's no doubt about it. And then the last thing I'll close with is, and it's been alluded to in a couple of folks on testimony, our process revisions. Spans of control are one issue, and levels of management are one issue that we face as a challenge in this institution that I can see. But quite frankly, it dwarfs compared to the issue of process control. Quite frankly, folks, we have guardians guarding the guardians who are guarding the folks watching the guardians. And we've got to figure out a little better balance. Not that we don't need to be prudent and we need to watch everything we do and we need to be accountable. There's no doubt about that. But we're a little out of control on the folks watching each other. So with that, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Director. Welcome aboard. And this committee is committed to working with you to help help look at this issue and find efficiencies. Committee members, if we can, I think we'll give the director a break since he's been on the job a short time. And I think it's a great subject, and we look forward to working with you, Mr. Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2020. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2788. Jan, give us a summary of this bill, please. And Representative Thatcher, I apologize. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. And
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2788, it includes the state treasurer as a state agency that's going to be subject to the Oregon Transparency website requirements, and it requires agencies to list separately the expenses for salaries and benefits as part of the human resource expenses on the website. Requires agencies to post notices of public meetings on the transparency website, declares an emergency effective on passage, and it's operative on January 1st, 2012. And you have before you a -1 amendment and a -2 amendment. The -1 deletes the requirement that salary and benefit expenses be listed separately, and the -2 deletes that same requirement, and it also deletes the requirement to post notices of public meetings.
Thank you very much. Representative Thatcher, good morning. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Good morning. I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And last year I had the very good fortune of working with you, Mr. Chair, and with Representative Smith, as well as Representative Speaker Roebland now, to pass what is now, I believe, a landmark legislation creating the new Oregon Transparency website. This website's been up and running for just a little over a year. I believe it's getting pretty good reviews. We're getting better and better as time goes on.
It contains,
Yes, better than an F, right? Contains all sorts of information about state budget, sources of revenue, contracts, just all kinds of information. And we knew last year, reiterating, we would have to start from scratch and use whatever resources were available and develop the site and improve upon it as money and time became available. We've been very lucky to have such a good partner at the Department of Administrative Services, and I believe they're here in the audience, because so far they have been able to use existing resources to make this website become the success it has. The legislation in 2009 also set up the Oregon Transparency Advisory Commission to oversee the management of the site. Representative Smith and I have the privilege of serving on that. And this committee has been considering another bill, House Bill 2825, to add all the economic development projects that receive tax expenditures to the site in more detail than they are now. That bill is hopefully coming back to you soon. But today, I bring you the next step in the process, House Bill 2788, and the bill's pretty simple, and I'm going to be speaking to the amendments, and I'm hoping that you will look at the -1 amendments, because that one would include the State Treasurer's Office or add them to the site, and also place a place for the public to find notices for meetings for state agencies. We have talked to both the Treasurer's Office and the Department of Administrative Services, and we don't believe there's a significant fiscal for either agency. Now, back to the State Treasurer section of the bill. The late Ben Westland, almost reversed that, Ben Westland specifically had asked to have his office excluded from the website during the 2009 session when we developed the transparency website, because he had a concern about proprietary information getting disclosed. And I think those concerns have been addressed. And in fact, our new Treasurer Ted Wheeler has not only embraced the idea of joining the website or the transparency website, but his office has been voluntarily posting items to the site for quite some time, about several months now. Treasurer Wheeler has also taken many steps related to transparency in his agency that are not related to the website, and I hope that we can applaud that when that occurs in our various state agencies. As for the public meeting notices, I don't know about you, but I can't tell you how many times people come to me and just wish they knew, could get their arms around all the different public meetings that might affect them, and they just don't know how to find out about them. I think this would help them be able to track some of the fee increases or some of the policy changes that might affect our various constituencies and give them a place to go. It would create a central location for these meeting notices to be posted so that it would be more easily accessed and found by members of the public. I believe the committee has been provided with some illustrations of how the Department of Administrative Services has already developed these kind of online calendars, and so they could utilize this online calendar, it looks sort of like this, to track where and when these public meetings might be taking place. I should mention that the Transparency Advisory Commission met a couple of times in the past 6 months and is real close to releasing its first annual report, if it hasn't already. It's due out about now. The components of this bill, House Bill 2788, were discussed and supported by members of the commission. There's at least one other member of the commission here to testify in support of the bill. And I'm, with that, happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Representative, would you please tell the committee we have two amendments in which...
Yes, the Dash 1 amendments leave... They basically take the bill as it is and take out the compensation, total compensation piece that was in there. That is actually something the commission can do anyway, but it just makes the bill more palatable, I believe, for the members of the committee, and leaves in the part that adds the state treasurer to the transparency website. Last session, we had specifically exempted them. We want to make sure that, I mean, notwithstanding our current treasurer, that continues forward. Okay. And then it also posts public meeting notices.
Okay, Dash 1 will have the meetings posted.
Yes, not the Dash dollars. 2
The bill has both in it.
The bill has both, but it also has compensation and total compensation added to it. We took that out of the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. There's three basic components
in
the original
bill.
Yes, ma'am,
Representative, which...
I'm hoping you will adopt the Dash 1s.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
I believe that one has the most support.
Committee members' questions? Representative Smith?
Thank you. I want to thank Representative Thatcher for bringing the bill, and she's right about the, or at least amplify her comment about the treasurer's request as we were passing the bill to leave out the treasurer's office, and given our acknowledged challenges that we knew we had to clear trying to do something in a challenging budget environment with the significant help of the Department of Administrative Services, having any constitutionally elected official risking potentially a frontal assault on the bill might have crushed our perniciously thin reed, and now it is I think a chance to pass it and pass the treasurer's portion, which I think would be really valuable.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Thatcher, for bringing this bill on your leadership and the transparency effort. Thank you, and your staff.
Thank you.
And DAS. I have two people else to sign up. Mike Savaglio, do you want to speak? And also Dugan Petty and John Bartholomew, you want to come up too? Good morning, and please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Good morning, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I'll be very brief and just say that everything that Representative Thatcher stated was absolutely correct. We have no fiscal impact. We believe that the concerns that we had in 2009 have been fully addressed, and we are pleased as punch to be invited into this website.
Thank you very much, Mike. Does the Treasurer prefer Dash 1 or Dash 2 with the basic bill?
Chair, Wisnet, members of the committee, I don't believe that we have a preference either way. There was some discussion over what kind of workload it would take to make sure that all of the public records were, or public meeting notices were in. We decided that, we took a look at that and decided we've already got some kind of database for that on our own website, which I'm pretty sure the DAS can hook into.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Petty?
Co-Chair Wisnet, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services and the State's Chief Information Officer. Our preference is for the Dash 1 amendment to the bill. Our piece of this is to develop a methodology and approach, and I think you've got copies of what we would propose to build for the noticing. This, to me, is very much like where we were at when we initially passed the bill the first time. It is figuring out what kinds of capabilities we can bring to it at our existing funding level and at least get a start on it. And so what you have in front of you in terms of what we propose to do for noticing requirements, we have the capability to embed that into the site. It will, from our perspective, it will involve creating a very simple template for agencies to fill out their meeting information and then post that online. And then that will allow us to display by agencies a list of meetings as well as calendars and people who will be able to come into the site as they currently can now with the with the improvements we've made to the transparency site can set up the views that they want to see for this information. So we've gone out and looked at what other states have done in terms of providing meeting notices, and I'll tell you right now that this is not as robust or as deluxe as we might like it to be. I think we would all like to see something that is right up there at the top of the list, but it is what we can do right now, and we can stand this up relatively quickly, and I believe meet the intent of the bill, and we're committed to do so.
Thank you. I'll finish. I hope, based upon my experience with you and your hard work on 2500, I'm sure we'll get an A next time on our rating.
We'll see. Co-Chair Wisnan, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew, policy advocate with OSPIRG. We statewide consumer advocacy organization with thousands of members across the state. I just want to make a couple points. One is that transparency websites in general are really popular among the public. There's actually a three-year-old poll now that stated that about 30% of the public has actually gone online nationwide to look for information about government spending. And that was before about 10 states, including our own, even had transparency websites. So that number's got to be larger. I would note that people use this information in a variety of different ways. People use it for academic or professional research. Some use it just to know more about their government. Some people use it to create new web applications to present data in a certain way that maybe they think is going to make them some money. But it's all used in a number of different ways. I do want to commend Mr. Petty and the other folks at DAS for making significant improvements to the site over the past year that did improve the grade. And it was my organization nationally that graded all 50 states. We are now ranked number 9th in the nation. And it's actually a B minus. So we do have
room. Oh, you got to rub it in, man. I was writing a nice note about you.
Well, we were at a D last year, so this is a real significant improvement. A lot of the work from the data.oregon.gov project has really gone a long way to improve this. 2788 will continue to make yet more improvements to this site. The issue with the state treasurer's office, I mean, the public should be able to see at a checkbook level what the treasurer's office does with their tax dollars. And the issue with the meetings, the meeting notices will allow people to see when a meeting is for so many different things, rulemaking, license hearings, trainings, other topics. And right now, citizens have to go to multiple websites or contact the agencies, check for notices in the newspapers. It can be kind of difficult, and this is a really good tool for consolidating all that information in one place. And it's, you know, important for it to be on the state transparency website, because this is a budget transparency website, and those hearings are where a lot of decisions get made on how government spends money. So what this kind of does is allows for the transparency site to go beyond just showing information to providing a way for the public to actually get involved in the decision-making processes more actively. So we very much support this and hope that we do continue to make improvements to get our grade up to the A that we all aspire to. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Committee members, questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. And okay, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2788. So this one's ready to go.
Yes, that's ready.
Okay, committee members, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2631. Jan, update us on this bill, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2631 was heard by the committee on March 8th. Representative Schaffler testified. This is the bill that basically prohibits in-kind contributions in public contracts. There is no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact was issued. There were no amendments either.
Does Paul do that first in the discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2631 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Chair Hovey moves House Bill 2631 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Committee members, discussions? Representative Sheehan.
So as I understand it, this prevents someone who's, say, an alumni of a university from bidding on a construction project and essentially comping a certain amount of the project. No?
Let me answer. You want to try to address that, Jan? But my understanding is no, you just have to publicize it. Is that...
The bill allows, as long as the advertisement, the solicitation for the bid, states that they will accept an in-kind contribution or monetary gift, then it's allowed.
Oh, all right. I guess that satisfies my...
So it's got to be open, though. You can't...
Okay.
Yeah.
Smith,
yeah, my understanding was it wasn't to be used in the evaluation. Right? It wasn't to be considered in the evaluation. I don't know how realistic that is, but you know, but my understanding was it wasn't supposed to be considered.
So would that prevent them then from saying, like, if you have a construction project and you're an alumni of that school, to say, well, we're not going to charge you for the cement in this project, and have that go into the bid? Would that prevent them from doing that? I'm just trying. I don't want to cause anything that. Or do anything that causes them to not leverage the generosity of their alumni.
Well, Mr. Chairs and Representative Sheehan, I do believe it prohibits that unless it was stated up front in the solicitation and the advertisement that they would accept the in-kind contribution, so that everybody knew that it would be open to those in-kind contributions and monetary gifts, then that would be allowed. Otherwise, they could not use it to evaluate the contract.
So there is the mechanism in place to allow for the in-kind contribution.
Stating up front in the advertisement and the solicitation.
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. Other questions, committee members? So are we ready to move?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just point out, I think I heard Jan say that the monetary contributions could be accepted if the notice is given, or if the bid request advertisement has stated specifically that it could be.
Yes.
I don't think that monetary is just in kind.
Representative, maybe it would be best if I just read the summary. Could I do that, please? Okay, it allows a contracting agency to accept and consider an in-kind contribution, not a monetary gift directly. Bidder or proposer, if the solicitation and the advertisement stated that such a contribution would be accepted and considered,
that it prohibits a contracting agency from considering a monetary donation or an in-kind contribution in evaluating the responsiveness of a bid or proposer or the responsibility of the bidder or the proposer. It will also prohibit a contracting agency from using a monetary donation or an in-kind contribution to offset, to reduce, or modify a bid or cost proposal. And it prohibits a contracting agency from using a monetary donation or an in-kind contribution in determining which bid or proposal complies with the least cost policy.
Any members?
I think those are good questions. If you're not ready to move this, we can move on.
I also want to point out, I think that if you have concerns about whether or not this would reduce a university's ability to get in-kind donations, it's actually important to read how in-kind donation is defined. Because what I think this would do, and I'm not 100% sure that I've got it, but what I think it would do is if you stated that you were going to, if you were a bidder and you stated that you were going to give the in-kind donation, it couldn't be contingent on receiving the bid. And I think that probably would have the effect that Representative Sheehan has suggested might be a concern. I'm kind of agnostic and uncertain about what the right decision is from a policy standpoint on this. And I remember we received testimony from contractors, and it was in favor of the bill.
I
cannot remember whether the universities testified or not.
No, but in the testimony we had private small contractors who were encouraging the bill, and I think on this one AGC endorsed this one. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, from my recollection, nobody spoke in opposition to this bill. However, I don't know that I'm fairly certain AGC did not testify on this particular proposal. I think the goal of this bill is to essentially prevent kickbacks for getting an award to win a contract. It's a very dicey situation in how we define that. We can certainly hold the bill over if the committee wishes to have further discussions with it. And certainly there's the Senate side of the building that also can take up this issue too. So I think it's completely up to the committee.
If the majority of the committee would like to have further discussions, we can bring it back. So.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't necessarily say that'd be a good idea if we don't have the space on our calendar to move it later. I think Co-Chair Holby really kind of captured the issue, and if the goal is to prevent that kind of kickback arrangement, I favor that. But I'm not sure I understand that this bill is drafted in a way that it just has that effect.
Representative Matthews?
I'm in favor of what I think this is supposed to get at, and I think that's where Representative Conger's at, and I think maybe perhaps the whole committee. And I've been reading the bills and going through the definitions, and for me, the issue is contracts shouldn't be awarded based on promises granted of what they'll deliver back, and the kickback is my concern. I think a lot of smaller firms don't have the ability to underwrite things or to perhaps low bid just simply because they're going to get a kickback on the end result. So if this prevents that, I'm supportive, and I'm okay having the vote. I just don't know how we're going to follow up to make sure that we are passing good, solid policy that we can live with if it comes back or goes over to the Senate, we never see it again. That would be my only concern. I'm prepared to vote on it. I think it attacks the intent that I had and that Representative Schaffler has. So,
committee members, there seems to be. I think our objective should be to pass the best legislation possible. So let's have some. We'll bring it back, reschedule or carry over.
We had extra time yesterday. Can we carry it over to yesterday?
Yes.
The motion was made.
The time machine.
The motion was made. I think you should ask if there's any objection.
Is there any objection if we withdraw Representative Hovey's motion? If Representative Hovey withdraws his motion.
Objection.
Okay, you need to state that. So you just need to withdraw your motion.
There was no objection.
Thank you, committee members. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2631. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2244. Update, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2244 was heard on February 10th, and there was another hearing March 1st from the Secretary of State's office. It expands the definition of public record to include information in any form for purposes of public records retention and disclosure law. It requires each state agency to have a written policy on use, retention, and collection of public records, and that it be approved by the archivist. It applies to public records in existence on the effective date of the act or created on or after the effective date. And there's a -3 amendment that came from Representative Conger. I don't know if he wants to describe the amendment.
Would you please do that, Representative?
-3.
I'm still on the prior bill. The -3 amendment, what it does is it changes the definition of public record very slightly to incorporate a concept that was in the original statute that says that in order for a record to become public, it would have to be in the possession or produced by an agency. And the goal of the amendment, the concern that I raised, was that the definition as it had without the -3 amendment, the definition construed very broadly on its plain language would it also include records and correspondence that had never been submitted to a public agency, so private records could be picked up technically by that definition. So we just tried to clarify that it's only things, only records that are produced by or in the possession of, submitted to a public agency.
Thank you, Representative. And his Justice Department is referenced in here. There are they... You added them specifically for
no, they're not in the. Are you talking about the -3 or the bill,
Mr. Chair? That was in the earlier version that the Secretary of State worked out with the Judicial Department. Okay. That was so in an earlier amendment, so it's carried forward in the -3 amendment.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was.
Yeah, your definition is in, but then they added the records from the judicial department. Committee members, the archives director is here if there's any questions of her. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, I'm open to a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments dated March 23rd, 2011 be adopted to House Bill 2244.
Chair Hovey moves -3s dated March 23rd, 2011 into the bill. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair, I would like to hear from the archivist on the -3s if we could.
Mary Beth, would you please come up? Thank you. Please identify yourself. And
co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Mary Beth Herkert. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. And the -3 amendments are a result of a meeting that we had with Representative Conger. In narrowing and taking it to its broadest terms, the capable of retention would, in its broadest terms, do exactly what he said it was going to do, which would potentially include private records, which was never the intent. It was only the records that were either received, filed, or created by a public entity. So we think that the -3 amendments do cover that and make it very clear that it has to be either owned by the public entity or created by the public entity.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for the director? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further discussions on the -3s into the bill? Okay.
Let me do the roll call. Do you want
you
to do a roll
to.
Call?
You can do without objection if you want.
Your preference.
Okay. We'll accept the -3s into the bill without objection. Chair Hovey?
We're not moving.
We're not moving the bill. I didn't know that. Okay. Okay, we'll close the work session. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2244. Open a work session on House Bill 2550. Jan, please update us on this bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the committee heard this February 17th. It's a bill that authorizes the director of the Department of Revenue to enter into federal and state intergovernmental agreements governing reciprocal offsets of certain payments against debts. I'd ask that you look at the Dash 3 amendment that replaces the printed bill. It's an expansion of the current reciprocal offset intergovernmental agreements that the Department of Revenue has with the U.S. Financial Management Service and the United States Internal Revenue Service. It would include the offset of other payments, not just tax refunds, and in payment of liquidated debt, not just tax obligations. So it expands the existing program. And we have someone from Department of Revenue here.
Do we want to move the Dash 3s first and then have the discussion? You want to have... Okay. Mrs. Buchanan, would you please come up? Thank you, Deborah. Please identify yourself and if you can provide us some testimony on the Dash 3s.
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. The Dash 3 amendment, as staff indicated, would expand the current provisions in the law that allow the offset of state tax refunds against federal tax debt or federal tax refunds against state tax debt. In 1996, Congress authorized the federal government to enter into agreements with states whereby federal vendor payments may be offset against state debt or state payments may be offset against federal debt, and the state payments would include state tax refunds or state vendor payments. So the current language in the law, 305.612, is amended to authorize that expansion.
Thank you. Committee members, questions?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment dated March 25, 2011 be adopted to House Bill 2550.
Chair Hovey moves the Dash 3 amendments dated March 25, 2011 into House Bill 2550. Objections? Seeing no objections, the amendments Dash 3s are moved into the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2550 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Chair Hovey moves House Bill 2550 to the floor with a do-pass as amended recommendation and the bill be referred to House Revenue by prior reference. Any further discussion, committee members? Seeing none, Mrs. Sullivan, to vote, please.
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisner? Aye. Okay, the bill passes. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2550. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3360. Committee members, Jan, you want to give us an update? We've had a lot of meetings, and we have a major amendment to the bill. You want to?
Mr. Chairs and committee members, House Bill 3360 was heard by the committee on March 8th. Mm-hmm. It requires state agencies to report vacant positions to the Department of Administrative Services when the position has been vacant for a continuous six-month period and it's a full-time equivalent budgeted position. We direct your attention to the Dash 2 amendment that replaces the printed bill. Directs the agency that wishes to retain a vacant position to report to DAS director the reasons why they wish to retain it. Requires the director to prohibit an agency from filling the vacant position if the director determines the reasons are insufficient. It requires the director to report quarterly to the Legislative Assembly on actions taken regarding vacant positions. And excludes from vacancy reporting requirements the Legislative Assembly, courts, Public Defense Service Commission, Secretary of State, and the State Treasurer. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has not been issued yet, and the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Jen. Committee members, you remember the testimony. This was exciting testimony on this bill. I want to compliment and thank the co-chair for working with me on this bill.
He brought up some concerns and recommendations, and we've had a couple of work groups with BAM and DAS and LC. And the bill, the amendment that you have before you, myself and Coach Chair Hobie will be prepared to answer questions. We had the original bill that I brought forth was sort of simple, and we had to address some constitutional issues, whether the executive branch and the legislative branch, what they could and could not do. I think the draft bill, I again compliment LC too on the draft and working on this issue. And I guess myself and Representative Hovey are prepared for questions if you have any questions on this. And we'll also bring up the DAS director and the BAM director if you have questions. So, has anyone had time to look at the DAS 2s?
I haven't seen it.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to go down there and...
No, sir. You can testify from here.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Just for, I guess, a little bit of clarity for the committee members, I think Chair Wisnett did a great job in describing what we got to, and I really do appreciate him bringing the bill forward and us being able to talk to each other and listen to each other about our concerns about this bill. And I think we came out with a much, much better bill that accomplishes the goals. One of the main pieces of the bill that we did change was not allowing DAS to actually eliminate positions and reappropriate the budget, because I felt pretty strongly that was a legislative direction. And so this bill basically accomplishes that, but also makes the legislature much more nimble and much more able to respond to our revenue collections as they don't meet our forecast budgeted forecasts, so that we will be able to look at those vacant positions, decide. The legislature then will receive the reports from DAS on whether they have directed agencies not to fill those vacant positions, and then the legislature will decide if they want to take those positions away and reappropriate that money before it's actually allotted, I guess. That would be my hope, that that process happens before the quarterly allotments, and that the legislature will be able to decide whether or not they want to tinker with it at that point. So I'll thank the co-chair again for being patient with me and working with me to make this a great bill, I think.
Since they're here, Director Jordan and Mr. Nonnington, Director Nonnington, would you want to come up and make any comments on what we've come up with? Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Co-chairs, for the record, Michael Jordan, Director of DAS, Acting Director. The only comment I would have is I appreciate your work. The original bill that I saw, which I wasn't involved in any of the original discussions, but my only real concern was the issue of I don't think I have the authority to reappropriate money, and so I wanted to make sure then, and you've taken care of that issue. George, obviously a lot more understanding of the nuts and bolts of how we would go about this, but my understanding is we already have the reports on a quarterly basis, so it doesn't really impose any extra burden on us to be able to do the reporting to the legislature. And at least in my experience as a manager, we should be reviewing vacant positions on an ongoing basis and trying to understand where we're headed and the trajectory of our revenues and all of those things. So I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you putting on the record that you know, you are producing the reports that will be used to make these decisions. And Director Nonnington?
Members of committee, George Nonnington, the Administrator of Budget and Management Division, we do appreciate working with the co-chairs. I do think this provides a tool to the director that he can then use to manage state government. Good opportunity.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions of these directors? They've stayed here all day, and thank you very much for doing that. Okay, any other discussions, committee members? Hearing none, we have to do
Chair Hovey, the dash two.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment dated March 23rd, 2011 be adopted to House Bill 3360.
Chair Hovey moves the dash two amendments dated March 23rd, 2011 into House Bill 3360. Any opposition? Seeing none, they're so moved. And we do have the committee members, we have the fiscal report, impact report, and we heard from the
just came in while we were
okay. And we heard from the director. So,
Mr. Chair,
Chair Hovey,
I move House Bill 3360 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Chair Hovey moves House Bill 3360 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Mr. Sullivan, vote please. Excused.
Representative Trump?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Hovey?
Aye.
Chair Wizard?
Aye. Is there a camera person here from press? We can shake hands.
When Dad made up, it's wonderful.
Okay, the motion passes, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3360. Okay, we'll now open a work session on 3487. Jan, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3487 was before you on March 17th. It specifies that new or increased state agency fees adopted following adjournment sine die of a regular session of the Legislative Assembly will be rescinded on adjournment sine die of the next regular session unless authorized by legislation. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. A fiscal impact statement was issued, and the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and there are no amendments before you.
Thank you, Jen. Committee members, remember, this is a bill that I brought forth. I really would like to have gone a step further and say that agencies could not adopt a fee after we adjourn. I decided not to climb that hill. I just went up the hill part of the way. And what this bill does, agencies have the authority to raise fees after we adjourn. The bill says the legislation in place now, they would have had to wait till the next biennium. This bill just says our annual session, it will have to be justified or it goes away. So any questions?
Just after having to have painful fee-raising discussions, this only applies to agency raising of fees, not, for example, the hunting and fishing licenses. We don't have to revisit that every session if it's done by an act of the legislature.
It's not legislative. It's, okay. It's agencies that raise the fees, thank you, Representative Clement, after we've adjourned.
Frustration in your voice.
Any other questions, committee members?
Not every session.
Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Chair Hovey moves House Bill 3487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Mrs. Sullivan, vote please.
Representative Bailey?
Excused.
Representative
Clinton? Aye.
Representative
Calder? Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye.
Chair Wizard?
Aye. Motion carries. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3487.
That's another committee.
Okay.
The
committee meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thanks for all your work.